You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 16th. I'm Jessica from Drake University. Here's our first story. The first headline reads, COVID-19 spread is very low across Iowa. The number of new weekly hospital admissions of people infected with COVID-19 in Iowa has been dropping steadily since the start of the year. The rate is now among the lowest rates of the pandemic, according to the U.S. Center of Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC reported 41 of those admissions in a recent week, down from a peak of 411 in December, which was the highest rate in more than a year. A Friday report by the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services classified the spread of COVID-19 in Iowa as very low. That report also listed no new deaths associated with the disease for the first time this year. Up to 44 infected people died last week in the latest surge of cases, according to CDC data. The uptick in hospitalizations began in the late summer in 2023, accelerated in December to its peak, quickly retreated in January, and has been steadily declining. A total of 11,650 people with the disease have died in Iowa during the pandemic, which began in early 2020. State health officials estimate that about 15% of Iowans have up-to-date immunizations to protect them against COVID-19. The next headline reads, amended bill to arm school staff returns to the House. A bill that would allow trained school staff to carry firearms on school grounds is headed back to the Iowa House. Senate Republican lawmakers last week amended a House bill that would create a new permitting process for Iowa school districts and armed trained staff. School districts would not be required to arm staff. Rather, the bill provides requirements for those districts to choose to do so. The measure also provides qualified immunity to school districts and school employees for criminal or civil liability for all damages incurred pursuant to the application of reasonable force. Approved staff would be allowed to carry concealed weapons during school hours. It would be up to the districts to decide what firearms staff could carry and whether the district would provide those or allow the use of personal firearms. House File 2586 cleared the GOP-controlled Senate, 30-14. Senator Charlie McClintock, R. Albernett, joined Democrats in voting against the measure. Senate lawmakers, however, removed a provision in the bill that would have established a school security personnel grant program that would match up to $50,000 for employing school resource officers or security personnel, sending it back to the House. The legislation comes in the wake of January's fatal shooting at Perry High School. Principal Dan Markberger and one-year-old Amir Joliffe were killed and six others were injured. The 17-year-old shooter died of self-inflicting gunshot wound. Tennessee lawmakers advanced a similar proposal Tuesday. Supporters say reasonable time is critical. Supporters of the bill said the fastest way to respond to a school shooting is to have armed personnel on site, trained and available to respond at the moment's notice. The bill gives school board the option how to best protect the children and strengthen what is already allowed under Iowa law, said Senator Lynn Evans, a former school administrator who floor managed the bill. We live a pretty comfortable life in Iowa, and it only takes seconds for that comfortable life to be taken away, Evans said. Parents, law enforcement, and school superintendents from rural communities, as well as gun rights activists, have said while school resource officers play an important role in Iowa schools, it is unrealistic to expect a single police officer is just going to be at the right place at the right time should tragedy strike. They argued that it could be particularly helpful in rural counties with limited law enforcement resources. Seconds count when law enforcement are minutes away, even in the quickest response, said Senator Chris Corner. In most mass shootings, the shooting stops when the good guys show up. The bad guys with a gun is stopped by the good guy with a gun. Corner stresses the bill doesn't force districts to participate, but those districts that wish to arm staff, it would create a deterrent. An evil individual who would not go to a place where they know there is armed resistance, Coroner said. There are people in this building carry concealed, including in this chamber, and we are all safer because of it. This bill is perspective. The training is thorough and ongoing, and it is a way to keep our kids safer at school. And it's the decision of the local boards and the people who choose to participate. Opponents say firearm increases risk. Senate Democrats contend arming teachers put lives of students, teachers, and law enforcement in danger, and warned of the potential of firearms at school to be stolen or misused. There have been more than 100 publicly reported incidents in the last 5 years of students and teachers finding unsecured firearms in bathrooms, locker rooms, and even sporting events, according to Griffith's Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. The only thing I want to arm teachers with are books and supplies, said Senator Janice Weiner. Democrats also disputed the notion of a highly trained teacher armed with a gun being able to respond as quickly as trained law enforcement. Law enforcement officers receive hundreds of hours of training, but the bill would allow armed personnel to carry in schools, potentially with much less training, they argued. The Iowa chapter of Brandy United Against Gun Violence criticized Iowa Senator Democrats for not proposing a safe storage amendment to the bill. The proposed amendment would have required the Iowa Department of Public Safety to create a mandatory statewide standardization system for safe storage of any firearms brought on school property by school employees, according to the group. The amendment would have provided strict procedures for loading and unloading firearms placed in or removing from safe storage. Most professional educational organizations have rejected the call to arm teachers, as the National Association of School Resource Officers and the American Bar Association. Instead, Democrats urged Republican lawmakers to prioritize violence prevention, intervention, and gun safety laws, such as universal background checks and extreme risk protection orders, and increased mental health supports for students. There are a lot of ways that we could instead of reactive, to protect our students, said Senator Molly from Cedar Rapids, who has worked for 33 years as a special education teacher. Volunteers from Iowa chapters of Moms Demand Action and Students Demand Action joined Senate Democrats in voicing strong opposition to the bill. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, but expecting a different result, and that's exactly what's happening here, said Chloe Geyer, a Drake University student, gun violence survivor, and volunteer leader with Students Demand Action chapter, a student-led group advocating to end gun violence. Guns are turning our school into graveyards, and yet Iowa lawmakers are hell-bent on arming our teachers as a response, Geyer said. It literally defies all common sense. Hundreds of students across Iowa walked out of school to protest gun violence, calling for an end to the massacre of children and calling on lawmakers to consider stronger gun laws following the Perry High School shooting. State House Republicans have pushed to loosen gun laws over the years, including allowing the permitless carry of handguns in 2021. What does the bill do? Iowa code currently allows approved school staff to carry guns on campus, should they choose. Two school districts in Northwest Iowa put policies in place, but later rescinded them years later to avoid being dropped by their insurance carrier for liability coverage. This year's legislation looks to address the insurer's concerns by putting in place a new permitting process that allows employees at Iowa's public and private schools and colleges to carry a firearm on school grounds during school hours. Republican lawmakers said the intent is to bring insurers back to the table and said they're confident the permitting, training, and immunity provisions in the bill will alleviate insurance concerns. In order to receive a professional permit to carry weapons, school employees would have to pass an annual background check and complete a firearm safety course in addition to one-time legal training on issues like qualified immunity, as well as an annual communication and emergency medical training, plus quarterly live firearm trainings. Identities of school staff issued a weapons permit would be confidential and would not subject to disclosure under Iowa's open record law. The next headline reads, Independent has Iowa nominating convention. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was formally nominated as a candidate for president in Iowa on Saturday, as hundreds of his supporters gathered in West Des Moines to hear the independent candidate speak. The campaign event functioned as a nominating convention for the We the People Party, the moniker Kennedy's campaign is using in several states to achieve ballot access. Kennedy urged the people gathered at the rally to abandon their two major presidential candidates. He cast himself as a way to unite a divided American electorate and address political polarization. Neither of these presidents is capable of ending the polarization, which is also toxic and existential for our country, he said. We don't know how it's going to end unless we take responsibility today for ending that polarization. The son of former U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy and nephew of former President John F. Kennedy, Kennedy has launched an independent presidential campaign after running an unsuccessful primary challenge to President Joe Biden. Last month, he selected Silicon Valley attorney Nicole Shannon as his running mate. Kennedy had a career as an environmental lawyer and rose to prominence in part promoting conspiracy theories about vaccine and public health. He took aim at pharmaceutical companies, large financial corporations, and political leaders, whom he considers part of a corrupt political system. While the We the People Party is not legally a political party in Iowa, the state allows non-party political organizations to nominate candidates for presidential via convention. The organization must have 500 residents present to vote for a presidential and vice presidential candidate. The campaign had 686 eligible electors sign in on Thursday, an official said. Kennedy described Republican former President Donald Trump and Democratic President Joe Biden as aligned on issues of federal spending, public health, and military action. He said the two major parties differ only on cultural war issues. None of them are actually the issues that are existential for our country, he said. The issues that are important if we want to see the survival of our country, if we want to see prosperity for our children, if we want to see the moral authority of our nation restored. Third-party candidates have historically fared poorly in presidential elections. But Kennedy said he believes this is the year a third-party candidate can win the election, capitalizing on voters' dissatisfaction with both Biden and Trump. Polling on Kennedy's support is spotty, but he has lodged 10 to 15% of support in some recent national polls, according to 538, while other polls have him in the low single digits. Kennedy said he is confident he will get on the ballot in all 50 states. Brad Young, 39, of Council Bluffs, said he supported Kennedy's environmental protection and his activism on the purported link between childhood vaccines and autism. Several studies have found no causal link between vaccines and autism, and a 1998 study that inspired the theory was retracted. Young said he did not vote for Trump or Biden in 2020, and he would not support either of them this year, regardless of Kennedy's ballot access. It's not just a Republican or a Democrat problem. It's obviously across the board, he said. Our elected officials are maybe just a little out of touch, so it would be great to have a third party. The next headline reads, Dozen water suppliers need to fix contamination. At least 12 community drinking water supplies in Iowa are unacceptably contaminated with enduring chemicals linked to various health alignments under new restrictions announced Wednesday by federal regulators. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency implemented a new drinking water standard that limits certain polyfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, commonly known as PFAs or forever chemicals, to almost none. It's the first time in more than a decade that the EPA has issued a new regulation that will require Iowa water suppliers to reduce or eliminate a contaminant for public safety, said Corey McCoyd, an Iowa Department of Natural Resources supervisor who oversees water supply compliance. It's a big deal, he said. PFAS persisted in the environment indefinitely and can accumulate in people's bodies, potentially causing a variety of illnesses and cancers. They are used in numerous products for their ability to repel oil and water, and the vast majority of Americans believe to have detectable amounts of them in their blood. Common sources of significant contamination include their manufacturers, such as 3M Company, landfills, and airports, and other sites where firefighter foam has been used. The new federal regulation will generally require water supplies that regularly serve at least 25 people to test for PFAS within the next 3 years and to mitigate its contamination within 5 years. That can be accomplished by finding alternate sources of water or installing equipment to remove the chemicals. DNR testing in recent years of water supplies that are most likely to be contaminated has revealed 12 that will be affected by the new rules, McCoy said. They include utilities that provide drinking water for residents in Buffalo, Burlington, Camash, Davenport, Dubuque, Muscatine, Osage, Sioux City, and Tamina. Several cities with contaminated water have already worked towards fixing the problem, even if their PFAS concentrations are below the new federal threshold, McCoy said. They include Ames, Burlington, Central City, Rock Valley, and Tama. The new rules limit the two most prominent PFAS, PFOA and PFOS, to 4 parts per trillion, which is significantly higher than what current testing methods can detect in water. 3 other variations are limited to 10 parts per trillion. The EPA estimates that the restrictions will benefit about 100 million people and prevent thousands of deaths. The next headline reads, "Running out of words, U.S. Muslims losing patience with Biden's policies." Israel-Hamas war. Washington. Omas Siblani was sipping his morning coffee at the office when his phone buzzed with a message from one of President Joe Biden's advisors. As publisher of the Arab American News in Dearborn, Michigan, Siblani serves as the occasional sounding board, and the White House wanted to know what he thought of Biden's recent call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. After months of mounting concern over the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, Biden has publicly, albeit vaguely, threatened to cut the U.S. assistance to Israel's military operations in the Hamas-controlled territory. "This is baby steps," Siblani said, he responded. "What we need is giant steps rather than baby steps." The text exchange is an example of the behind-the-scenes communication that the White House has neutered as a time of anger at the Democratic president over his support for Israel. Such informal contacts have become more important as some Muslim and Arab American leaders have turned down opportunities to talk with Biden or his advisors, frustrated by the sense their private conversations and public anguish have done little or none to persuade him to change course. The White House says it is keeping an open door for difficult conversations, but it can be hard to get people to walk through. "All they're trying to do is convince us that there is some kind of movement towards where we want," Siblani said, "but it's too slow and it's dragging. It's more death and casualties that are happening." The highest profile example of the stonewalling came earlier this month when a Palestinian American doctor walked out of a meeting with Biden. But interviewers with Muslim and Arab American leaders reveal how the face-to-face protest was only the most conspicuous case of a fracture that had damaged crucial relationships and closed avenues needed to repair them. What more can we tell the White House for them to change course? "I've run out of words," said Michigan State Representative Abraham Alish, who met with senator officials in February but has not had any contact with them since. Dan Coe, deputy director of the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, said the administration wants to make sure we're as accessible as possible. "We understand that some people do not want to engage. We respect that," he said. "But we think that the people who have engaged have felt it was a fruitful discussion. Top White House officials, including National Security Advisors Jake Sullivan, Senior Advisor Anita Dunn, and Chief of Staff Jeff Zients has been involved in the outreach. Biden is briefed on their conversations, and Vice President Kamala Harris has talked with Muslims, Arab Americans, and Palestinian Americans. The White House believes it can still find representative audiences, such as recent series of meetings with Lebanese Americans, that focused on efforts to prevent the conflict from expanding along Israel's northern border, where Hezbollah operates. Iran attacked Israel early Sunday, launching more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel that were largely shot down by an international military coalition, including the U.S. The situation with U.S. Muslim leaders presents a challenge for a president who believes in the political power of personal relationships and has prized his history of sitting down with opponents and critics. It could also jeopardize his reelection this year, with some Muslims warning they are unwilling to support Biden even if it risks returning Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee to the White House. Salam al-Marati, who lives in Los Angeles and leads the Muslim Public Affairs Council, described the attitude as, "Forget them. They have to learn a lesson, and if they lose, that's the lesson they should learn." His disillusionment with Biden began soon after the war started on October 7th, when Hamas killed 1,200 Israelis in a surprise attack. The president described himself as a Zionist during a trip to Israel later that month, emphasizing his belief in the importance of a Jewish state as a guarantee of security for people who have historically been persecuted around the world. Al-Matari heard the statement differently. "What it meant was, he doesn't care for Palestinian people and their displacement," he said. Al-Matari and members of his organization did participate in meetings with officials from the National Security Council and State Department, but he sourced on the conversations. "We realized they were not listening," Al-Matari said. "Maybe they were nodding when they were speaking, but they were continuing with the same policy." With the war entering its seventh month, Israel has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, according to the Gaza-based Ministry of Health, an agency in the Hamas-controlled government. U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota who is Muslim, said it's important to support Biden as a shield against the return of Trump, saying our democracy is on the line. But when it comes to the war, Omar said Biden is not where we need him to be at the moment, and it is our job to push him and get him where we need to be. After a recent Biden call with Netanyahu, the White House said the president made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action to protect civilians and allow increased humanitarian assistance. The conversation came 2 days after Biden met with Muslim leaders at the White House. Officials have originally tied to arrange an iftar meal where Biden could join Muslims as they broke their daily fast for Ramadan after sunset. But too many people refused invitations, turned off by the thought of eating with Biden at the same time he is supporting Israeli military operations that have pushed Palestinians to the brink of famine. The White House changed its plans and hosted a private meeting about the war. One of the guests was Thayer Ahmad, a Palestinian-American doctor from Chicago who has volunteered in Gaza. Angry over the continued flow of U.S. weapons to Israel, Ahmad stood up during the meeting and told Biden he was walking out. Among the leaders who have kept talking about the administration is Wael Azalt, who lives in Washington, D.C., area and heads up the advocacy organization Imaj. The former U.S. Senator, U.S. State Department official, said he texts or calls senior officials to relay sentiments from Muslim and Arab American communities and pushed for a ceasefire. Dearborn Mayor Abdullah Hamad said he last met with administration officials in February, and they have reached out to ask his thoughts since then. The city has the largest Muslim population per capita in the country, and Hamad said he always is willing to talk if there's a conversation to be had that can lead to saving one life. The next headline reads, U.S. consumer sentiment down slightly, report says. Consumer sentiment about the U.S. economy has trickled down, but remains a recent high, with Americans' outlook largely unchanged this year. The University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index, released Friday in a preliminary version, slipped to 77.9 this month, down from March's figure of 79.4. Sentiment is about halfway between its all-time low, reached in June 2022 when inflation peaked, and its pre-pandemic averages. The survey has been conducted since 1980. The index has dropped to 61.3 as recently as November before jumping in the following 2 months by the most in more than three decades. It has since moved mostly sideways. Stronger consumer optimism can sometimes translate into more spending, which typically boosts the economy. Most economists expect consumer spending to remain healthy as long as the job market stays strong. In China, China's exports contracted in March after growing in the first 2 months of the year, underscoring the uneven nature of the country's recovery from the pandemic. Customs data released Friday show exports declined 7.5% in March from a year earlier, while imports slipped 1.9%. Both figures fell short of estimates. Apple Incorporation, aiming to boost sluggish computer sales, plans to overhaul its entire Mac line with a new family of in-house processors designed to highlight artificial intelligence. The company, which released its first Macs with M3 chips 5 months ago, is already nearing production of the next generation, the M4 processor. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 16th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Jessica from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this, or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. In the obituaries, Babette J. Mensching, age 81, of Council Bluffs, passed away April 13, 2024, at Jemmy Ennison Hospital. Babette was born November 25, 1942, in Council Bluffs to the late Nick and Alice Nosh. She graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1961, and 10 days after graduating, married Glenn Mensching on June 10th. They were blessed with four children, Jeffrey, Brenda, Bruce, and Brian. Babette worked at Jenny Emmonson Hospital for 25 years, retiring in 2005. In addition to her parents, Babette was preceded in death by her infant son, Jeffrey, grandson, Nick Podge, and brother, Will Nosh. Babette is survived by her husband of 62 years, Glenn Mensching, daughter, Brenda Ratty Pogue, sons, Bruce and Brian Mensching, four grandchildren, one great-granddaughter, sister, Colleen Ken Thompson, brother, Nick Nosh, nieces and nephews. Memorial service Thursday, 11 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment in Cedar Lawn Cemetery with a lunch following at the Walnut Hill Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Visitation with the family the half hour prior to the service on Thursday at the funeral home. Kathy Y. Rutfuss, age 73, of Pacific Junction, Iowa, transitioned to her heavenly home on April 9, 2024. She is survived by her husband, Barry, children, Barry Rutfuss, Jr., Carrie Rutfuss, Kelly Rutfuss, brothers Frank Carpenter, Harold Carpenter, grandchildren Blake, Carly, and Kiana Opal, Kemden and Lane Lethanol, David Ramos, and many other family and friends. Celebration of Life will be Saturday, April 20th, 2024, from 1 to 3 p.m. at Forest Lawn Funeral Home, 7909 Mormon Bridge Road, Omaha, Nebraska. Forest Law Funeral Home. The next headline reads, Jackets Sting Huskies in Opener of Border Battle. Thomas Jefferson's girls' soccer team spent most of the first half frustrated at shops, kept barely missing. Demi Payne then scored two late goals in the final 4 minutes of the first half, which helped open the floodgates to an 8-0 win at Gale Wickersham Stadium on Friday afternoon. Payne would score four goals to lead the Yellow Jackets past the Huskies. Though the Yellow Jackets dominated the time of possession and possession in general, the shots wouldn't just find the net for the first 35 minutes. Payne saw one of her shots go off the post along with two others before Payne broke the ice in the 36th minute with an unassisted goal. As frustrated as it can be, you just have to keep shooting, Payne said. I just kept taking shots as they came, and it felt really good to finally see that first one go in. We adapted to how Northwest was playing us and then started connecting with each other really well and pulled away. Payne scored again about a minute later off an assist from Grace Strong to put the Jackets up 2-0 at the break. Cicero Winland then scored the next two goals with assists from Riley Woods and Tayern Grant, specifically in the 52nd and 54th minute to double TJ's lead. From that point onward, the floodgates just kept opening more and more. Northwest played really congested defense back there, Yellow Jackets coach Mark Royer said. They made it difficult for us in terms of what we wanted to do. The girls got a little frustrated but started to figure out by adjusting their spacing, and it showed with those two late goals. Payne then scored two more to make it 6-0, both goals assisted by Strong. Vanessa Ramirez scored the 71st minute off an assist from Ava Reef, and McKenna Kramer netted a goal in the 75th minute to cap off the scoring. The defense also did well, as the Huskies were unable to generate much offense, leading to the Yellow Jackets' fifth shutout victory of the season. I can always rely on my defense to get back and turn them in outside instead of letting them get in the middle, goalkeeper Cameron Hostick said. Even when I do get a touch, my defense has been there to help me get the ball out and not allow another shot, and they really held it down today. The Yellow Jackets will look to keep things rolling on Saturday when they host South Sioux City at 4:45 p.m. The next headline reads, Glenwood Golden in 4x100, 4x200 at Sioux City Relays, the WIC to host state qualifying meet. Sioux City, Iowa, Glenwood was golden in the 4x100 and 4x200 at the 59th Sioux City Relays on Saturday. With a season best time of 43.59, the team of Jackson Muskins, Keaton German, Trey Darnan, and Peyton Longmire finished more than 1 second ahead of season place Atlantic in the Class B race. The same team of four set a season best time in the 4x200, winning in 1 hour 31 minutes and 57 seconds, ahead of Hinton by nearly 2 seconds. The Rams were also second in the girls 4x100 and 4x200. Zoe Carta, Brooklyn Schutz, Danica Arnold, Allie Coates, as well as the 4x400 Schlutz, Brecken Petson, Megan Hughes, Arnold. The boys were third in the 1600 sprint medley. Darden, Longmire, Cooper, DeLashmut, Andrew Smith. And 4x400, Victor Cruz, Bryce Keller, DeLashmut, Smith. Individually on the podium, the Rams had three silver medalists, Peterson, girls 400 hurdles, Smith, boys 800, Bryant, Keller, boys 1600. And four bronze medalists, Keegan Schmertz, Charnulis, boys shot put, Smith, boys 3,200, Grace Berglund, girls 3,000, Arnold, girls 400. Glenwood also placed 5 and 4th, Bryant Keller, boys 3,200, Smith, boys 1,600, Mulkins, boys 100, Coots, girls 100, Aiden Lopez, boys, 110 hurdles. Schultz, girls, 400. Carta, girls, 100. And DeLashmut, boys, 400, were 5th. And Cruz, 6th, 400. Underwood also competed in Sioux City. Their best finish came in the girls' shuttle hurdles as the Eagles placed fifth. Mallory Leaders, Emma Childers, Lexi Ganwish, Maddie Irwin. Gail Wickersham Stadium to host 4A state qualifying meets. The IGHSAU and IHSAA announced Monday that Abraham Lincoln and Gail Wickersham Stadium will host the 4A state track and field qualifying meet on Thursday, May 9th at 4 p.m. The next headline reads, Final Four showed access has changed a generation. I was on the verge of tears the whole while last weekend. If I'm being honest, but I had a beautiful reason to cry. Monday morning, I woke up at 4:30 a.m. Central Time to make the trek back to Davenport. It was early, but spending my entire weekend in Cleveland watching the Iowa Hawkeyes change the world of sports was worth every second. On my way back home, I started reflecting on things from the weekend. I knew the number one question was going to be, what was your favorite part? Honestly, that's an impossible question to answer. But if I had to, I would say it was the first time I let myself cry, Saturday afternoon. After a few long days of driving and waking and walking and basketball, I was able to attend an open practice for both the South Carolina Gamecocks and the Iowa Hawkeyes. South Carolina took the floor first, and I found a seat in the front row, a few feet away from the players. When their time was up, all players shuffled off the court, waving to the crowd as they went. Then came the event 19,000 people attended for, the Hawkeye Show. Practice is free to the public, but a sold-out arena just for warm-ups is completely unheard of. All around me, whispers of, I have never seen anything like this, came from camera crew and reporters sitting around me. I, too, had never seen anything like it, and that's why I finally cried for the first time, because as a kid, this is all I would ever have dreamed of, an opportunity to see it happening. Right before the tournament, I wrote about how I became a basketball fan, but I admittedly left out a few details. For those who didn't read it, the story is simple. I read a book on Lisa Leslie when I was 8 years old and have been a Los Angeles Sparks fan ever since. What I didn't tell you about the Christmas where I asked for a tape measure so I could mark where my free throw line would be on the driveway, or the Easter where I requested the bunny only bring me chalk so I could draw more basketball courts on the driveway. Free throw lines, 3-point lines, logos, and all. And what I most certainly didn't plan to tell you was about how I would flip laundry baskets upside down, grab a wooden spoon to use as a microphone, and stick it in my dad's shoe, my makeshift microphone stand, while I ran my own press conferences. This past weekend, I sat in a press conference and watched players field questions. I smiled thinking about my own humble conferences when I had to imagine the audience. I realized halfway through I was on the complete other side of the podium, and that's something I never expected. That was on my mind as I watched the championship game from my perch in the lower bowl, nervously hoping that Hawkeyes could pull off the upset. All around me, Hawkeyes fans cheered anytime anything went our way, easily drowning out the Carolina fans in attendance. At one point in the game, I overheard another journalist say she felt the crowd was overwhelmingly Iowa fans because the neutral site is closer to their school. It's an 8-hour drive from Iowa City to Cleveland. Gamecock fans only had to travel 1 hour more. Now, if you know me, I'm the last person to give directions. I'm terrible with geography, but even I can look that up on Google Maps. I took that comment to Twitter, where a talented and hilarious journalist from Northeast Iowa met it with this great quote. People don't seem to understand how well Iowans travel for their teams. You could play a game on Mars, and it involves Iowa or Iowa State. Those fans will be there, and they'll drown out the colony of Bush Light or whatever light space larger is available. I chuckled over the space larger comment the rest of the afternoon, even when I was in the post-game press conference when I was thrown off my game. Out of the sea, a male journalist, a 9-year-old girl, introduced herself as DJ Lily Jade of 95.5 FM in Cleveland and asked both Caitlin Clark and Kate Martin what advice they had for young girls. The big smiles on their faces showed this made their day just as much as it did for everyone else in the room, and they gave the usual advice, dream big and work hard. But what caught my attention was the look on Lisa Blutter's face, absolutely bewildered. She looked around to make sure everyone else saw her, was seeing what she was seeing. The old adage is you have to see it to be it. Within minutes of the championship game concluding, what was proven to be working. In that small conference room, 100 feet from the court, Blutter's face softened, then turned to pride as she listened to Lily Jade's question. The Hawkeyes coach blinked several times as she seemingly fought back tears at the realization that the next generation was already before her eyes. "You are well on your way, Lily," Blutter told her about her future success. "You're amazing." The juxtaposition of being the coach leading the most watched player in the women's college hoops to already seeing the payoff is completely uncharted territory, and we're just getting started. Friday, before the Hawkeyes faced UConn to advance to the national championship, the Las Vegas Aces announced they were moving their July 2nd game against the Indiana Fever to a larger venue. Sunday, the championship game against the undefeated Gamecocks and the Hawkeyes peaked at 24 million viewers, the most watched basketball game since 2019, and 285% increase in viewership from the 2022 Women's National Championship game. The following day, a week away from WNBA draft, the Phoenix Mercury dropped a poster advertising a June 30th game between them and Indiana Fever. Now, this is monumental for a few reasons. Clark, not even being drafted yet, although she is expected to make the move to Indiana as they have first dibs in the draft. While the Aces finished first in the league last year, the Fever were 10th and Mercury 12th out of a dozen teams. All of this must have caught the attention of WNBA executives, considering the Fever announced on Wednesdays 36 of their 40 games would be broadcast on national TV. In 2022, only 22 games made it to the big screen. Of those, only one was showed on ESPN. The same night, I found myself at lacrosse practice at Crow Creek Park in Bedford. I was passing out uniforms and casually tossed the number 22 jersey to one of my girls. Her mom and I shared a look we waited for to realize what she was wearing. "Do you know who else wears 22?" her mom asked as she pulled it on, adjusting to make sure it fit correctly. The answers were jaw drop were simultaneous. "I'm going to be just like Caitlin Clark," she said. As a kid, I had to make my own court and t-shirts. I drew huge logos on my driveway, advertising a team I could only catch if a game just so happened to be broadcast on Saturday mornings. Now we have nine-year-olds in press conferences. We have arenas fighting for the chance to show women's hoops. Viewers have proved the value of TV networks that if you, in the world of Clark, give women's sports a chance, it thrives. As I sat in that practice on Saturday afternoon, I realized it was a pivotal moment for women's sports. Behind me, hundreds of little girls shouted for Clark to look their way, to wave, to smile. She stayed focused, and in her defense, I don't think she could have heard them. It was that loud. But I think about how this would have made a difference for me as a kid. I didn't have access to major basketball games in person or on TV. All of that has changed in the past few years, and the proof was all around me in Cleveland. An 11-year-old girl from Western Springs, Illinois, held up a sign that said she started playing basketball because of Caitlin Clark. That girl lives 212 miles from Carver Hawkeye Arena. Before the game on Friday, three sisters, aged 9, 8, and 6, were dressed to the nines with Hawkeye gear. They are from Minneapolis, 302 miles away from Carter Hawkeye Arena. Ahead of Sunday's championship, I found an 11-year-old holding a sign reading, "I'm not a Swiftie, I'm a Clarkie." That girl was from Findlay, Ohio, 485 miles from Carver Hawkeye Arena. Then, of course, there were Quad City area kids I met along the way. The ones who dreamed of coming to Cleveland and proudly wore their 22 jerseys and only an hour drive from the University of Iowa. But here's what boils it down to. Iowa is not known for its women's basketball program. It's a fact Blutter addressed in her own press conference at UConn. Tennessee, Stanford, LSU, South Carolina, top of the list. Yet, for 19,000 people in person Saturday and 24 million people watching from home Sunday, it didn't matter. This was not a game about watching legacy teams battle it out. This was a game about underdogs, about an incredible squad pulled together by Dawn Stanley, About a million of little girls nationwide will never wonder why they can't see people who look like them on TV. Most importantly, this was a game for all girls who drew their own basketball courts and ran their own press conferences in hopes they could make it to the big stage one day, if they just worked hard, if they just believed, if they just dreamed. That game, that weekend, and beyond was about how dreams are for coming true. The next headline reads, all about the artichoke. Did you know that when you eat artichokes, you're eating flower buds that haven't bloomed? Artichokes are a pine cone-shaped vegetable that are in season in spring and fall. You can eat the artichoke leaves and heart, which refers to the fleshy center part of the plant inside its many layers and leaves, and below the inedible choke. Besides being incredibly delicious and easy to cook, artichokes have a ton of health benefits because they're packed with important nutrients. Nutrition experts list the unique benefits of artichokes and why they're such a healthy veggie. Number one, they're full of fiber. A medium-sized artichoke provides about 7 grams of fiber, which is almost 30% the recommended amount of 25 grams of fiber per day for a healthy adult woman, 38 grams for men. Fiber is important for keeping your gut healthy and improving your digestive symptoms, said Krista Linares, registered dietitian and owner of Nutrition Con Sabor. She adds that fiber also has a long-term health benefits, such as helping to improve cholesterol levels, reduce heart disease risk, and reduce diabetes risk. Artichokes are especially high in a type of fiber called inulin, said Ginger Holton, registered dietitian and owner of Ginger Holton Nutrition and author of the ebook Anti-Inflammatory Diet Meal Prep. Inulin is a highly fermentable fiber. This means that it's easily broken down and used by the good gut bacteria as a food source. In turn, the gut bacteria made byproducts that are beneficial to human health, like short-chain fatty acids, explains Holton. Short-chain fatty acids have been linked to lowering the risk of developing medical conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and inflammatory diseases. Number two, they're rich in potassium. Potassium is really important for blood pressure, Linares said. If you have high blood pressure, a lot of us naturally think we should reduce sodium. But the other thing we should be doing at the same time is increasing potassium. This is because your kidneys clear more sodium from your blood when potassium enters the bloodstream, lowering your blood pressure. Number three, they're a good source of folate. Healthy adults require 400 micrograms DFE of folate, or vitamin B9, per day. A medium artichoke has 61 micrograms of DFE or folate. Your body uses folate to form tissues, DNA, and red blood cells to help cells divide. This vitamin is particularly important for pregnant women who need to have 500 micrograms of DFE per day in order to help prevent neutral tube defects in the growing fetus. Number four, they're high in magnesium. A medium artichoke has 24% of the federal recommended dietary allowance of magnesium for a healthy adult woman. Magnesium is needed for your nerves, muscles, and heart to work well, for producing energy and for good control of your blood sugar and blood pressure, and to form protein, DNA, and bones. And number five, they contain vitamin C and other potent antioxidants. Artichokes provide you with the antioxidants which help reduce the amount of reactive oxygen species in the body. These are waste products formed by the body. Too many reactive oxygen species can result in excess inflammation, and long-term excess inflammation can increase the risk of a number of diseases. The next article reads, Household Hazards, How to Keep Pets Safe from Cleaning Products and Other Chemical Toxins. It's inevitable. When the season changes from winter to spring, there's always spring cleaning, or at least a plan to spring clean. It's an annual ritual. Unfortunately, many cleaning products can be dangerous or even deadly to our pets. According to the ASPCA, Animal Poison Control Center, exposure to household cleaning products and paint makes up 8.3% of all pet poison calls to the center. Depending on the ingredients in these cleaners, they can be a real hazard to your pets if they lick, inhale, or ingest them, or in some cases, if they come in contact with their skin or eyes. Labels on cleaning products may be difficult to read or interpret. The American Kennel Club offers the following information about spring cleaning products that may be harmful to your pets and what to do if you suspect your pet has been exposed to them. Know what you are using. Because there are many cleaning products on the market with different ingredients, all with varying degrees of safety, be sure to read the directions on the label prior to usage and for dilution instructions when needed. After cleaning, dispose of unused or dirty solutions in clean and put away cleaning tools such as mops or rags so the pet cannot get to them. Carpet cleaners. With carpet cleaners or fresheners, thoroughly vacuum and powder the carpet or rug before allowing the pet back in this area. This should prevent contact irritation with the product to the pet's skin and reduce the risk of inhaling the powder. With carpet shampoo, allow the carpet to dry before allowing pets back into the area. Fabric softeners. Fabric softeners contain ketonic detritus that have potential cause to significant signs of irritation such as drooling, vomiting, oral and esophagus ulcers, and fever. These signs occur when pet chews on a new or unused dryer sheet. Used dryer sheets have minimal amounts of detergent still present. However, if an animal ingests enough sheets, even used, an intestinal blockage can occur. Essential oils. Essential oils can cause significant problems in pets, but especially in cats. This can include irritation to the skin or tongue when the direct contact or gastrointestinal effects, neurological signs, and even aspiration pneumonia when ingested. Because there are variations in toxicity of certain oils and in their concentration, they are not recommended to use in homes with pets without strict dietitian's directions from a veterinarian. Vinegar and water. Vinegar and water dilutions are often used as an inexpensive alternate to commercial cleaning agents, but vinegar in its pure form is typically acidic and can still act as an irritant. Ingesting concentrated or undiluted vinegar can cause vomiting, diarrhea, oral irritation, and pain. Be aware. These different substances found in cleaning products are hazardous. Ammonia, bleach, chlorine, formaldehyde, pineal, and isopropyl alcohol. The bottom line is that most cleaning agents can be safely used in the home if you read and follow label recommendations and allow the ingredients to fully dry and evaporate before exposing pets back into the environment. Clinical signs. The following are common clinical signs of possible toxicity in your pet. When licked or ingest, drooling or excessive salivation, sometimes with fetid smell, vomiting, not eating, lethargy, hunched body posture indicating abdominal pain, wobbliness, or disorientation, seizures, convulsions, and coma. When inhaled, sneezing, coughing, or gagging, difficulty breathing or open mouth breathing, especially in cats, teary or red eyes, and bluish colored gums. When in contact with the skin, redness and irritation, scratching or biting the affected area, and blisters or sores. What to do if your pet is exposed to a cleaning product? Time is of the essence in these instances. Toxicity in pets varies greatly from mild to life-threatening, depending on the substance, the route of exposure, the amount ingested, and the size of the pet. Try to determine how your pet was exposed, which product was involved, and how much of the product was used. It was exposed to or ingested. If you question whether a product is toxic to your pets, or if you suggest that your pet has been exposed to any poisonous substances, take a photo of the product and packaging and contact the ASPCA, Animal Poison Control Center, 24-hour hotline at 888-426-4435, or call your veterinarian or nearest veterinary emergency hospital. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 16th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Jessica from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.